CliffCentral.com.
Yeah. Yes, indeed. Don't forget the MKT show today. It might be at 1 o'clock because of load shedding, but usually it's at 12. And if it is at 1 o'clock, I promise you it's not Bulelo, like skiving off and being lazy. We got to do what we got to do with load shedding going on. We're going to be joined in a little while by Jesse and Jaron Clegg. I'm very excited to talk to them. And there's still lots of comments coming in about all the load shedding and people just bringing up the fact that Matrix are writing exams at the moment. Can you imagine trying to, you know, do that in all of this craziness? We really, the adults of this country ought to be embarrassed about what they're doing to the children of this country. And also the fact that we've become okay with it, you know, for what is it? It must be close on 12, 15 years now that we've been putting up with this shit. And we used to be a net exporter of electricity. Remember, we used to have a surplus. I did promise I'd stop. Anyway, someone says here, Snaye says, is it Weza's voice on the 80s show ad? Since he came on the show, I assume his voice is on every ad. I think I heard his voice on the airport notifications and Fly Sapphire. I might be wrong there. Weza Matomane, who used to be one of our presenters of one of our shows here on Cliff Central, he's gone on to do amazing work. And he probably is one of the most in-demand voiceover artists in the country. So we're very proud of Weza and all the things he continues to do. I saw him in a TV ad the other day. So he's now the face of and the voice of a number of brands. So good for Weza. That's not his voice.
I think he's the airport guy as well.
Yeah, that's what someone was just saying now.
Yeah, no, I heard it the other day. I was like, oh, that's awesome. That's Weza.
You really need to catch the MKT show in the afternoons. Daily afternoon highlight is Bulelo Unleashed. Awesome. That's from Tracy. Well, you know, awesome. Like there are still people, there are a few people who still listen to radio. And I suppose if you do listen to radio, you like the fact that it's you get a morning show and you get an afternoon show. So you've got something to keep you company on the way home as well as on the way into work in the morning if you're actually going to the office. And if that is the case, now you've got the MKT show in the afternoons. So that's always good. Load it up. You can just download the podcast if you can't listen live. And listen to that later. It's all available in CliffCentral.com.
I heard a woman yesterday. I was listening to the radio in my car.
Were you? That's very advanced.
The wireless. And this woman had phoned in, and you could hear she was ill with flu. She said, "I'm sorry, it's my day off, because I'm really sick.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to phone and say hello to everybody." And the host said, "Well, what are you doing?" And she said, "I hope you're resting."
Yeah.
She said, "No, I'm cleaning my house. It's one of the few days that I've got to clean my house because I work really hard."
Mm.
And she said, "And I just want to say God bless to everybody and send my love. And everyone who's, I tell all my friends about this radio show." And my immediate reaction was, "Well, loser." But then I thought, shame, you know, this is this woman's life.
Yeah, it's what she lives
she's
for.
She's sick with flu.
No.
She thought about phoning into the radio station and sending everybody love. And I thought that was actually quite sweet.
No, it is sweet. Yeah. I mean, I used to cut people like that off because I was like, well, if you want to say hello to the people who you know, just phone them. Don't. Why involve the rest of us? It's got nothing to do with us. So Bulelo, please tell us the story about this female soccer player at PSG and what happened to her, because this is insane.
Yeah. So this woman called Aminata Diallo, right, got arrested yesterday after so she not only got her teammate assaulted, so her teammate, I just want to say her name correctly, I think it's Khaira or it could be Khaira Hamroy. But anyway, fellow PSG teammate who at the moment she plays the same position, right?
Mm-hmm.
And also there's a whole nother level. They're also France teammates. So not only do they both play the same position for PSG, but they play the same position for France. But yesterday she was arrested, right, for organizing two men to beat Khaira or Khaira with crowbars on her legs, which broke her arm. And so, and she was driving the car. That's the next level. Aminata was driving the car, which the two men came out of and dragged Khaira out of her car and beat her. And it looks like the motive at the moment is that obviously they played the same position. But
my God.
This is where we are. How crazy.
So let's just be clear. Like, this didn't happen in like Tajikistan or you know, Outer Mongolia. No. This happened in France for a professional team. PSG is probably one of the best female teams out
sounds
there.
It sounds like where I grew up. It sounds kind of normal.
Sounds like
for the
South.
Area.
Yeah.
It just sounds like the South. Yeah. It just sounds like a night at Lizito Land.
Oh my God.
But yeah, this is incredible, right?
Wow.
Is that it's like you said, it's in Paris, but also the next level is it's not a money problem, right? PSG, as I said, are owned by Qatar. Like Qatar, through the corruption of the World Cup, have essentially taken over PSG because a guy called so it's not a money thing. They're all making big money. The women's football there is thriving, but it was to take out my opposition player.
But this woman's obviously going to go to jail. I mean, she's broken the law and she's broken an arm of this other woman and possibly her leg. I mean, it's crazy though how this is like jealous spouse stuff, but in terms of professional football, it's crazy.
Yeah, listen, the French have an issue, right? Like the guy who's probably the most prodigal talent, Karim Benzema, came out and there was a little blackmailing incident that happened about 4 or 5 years ago, and he's in trouble now. He might go back to jail. So he plays for Real Madrid. He's one of the biggest stars in world football. He blackmailed his own teammate, Mathieu Valbuena, right, for a sex tape.
Oh my God.
To say, I'm going to release it. Yeah. So France, whoa, you guys need to get it under control. But if you haven't seen the Tonya Harding story, right? Tonya Harding, please go and look up that documentary. I mean, I don't want to go on too much about that, but Amanita Diallo. That's the world we're living in.
They were Tonya Harding was a skater, right? She was an ice skater.
Nancy Kerrigan. In fact, her boyfriend, Jeff Galuli, was the guy. He actually organized the whole situation. And I don't want to spoil it because I think everybody must watch that Tonya Harding documentary.
He did such a good job on breaking Nancy Kerrigan that we named the Galulis interchange after him. Did you know that? All right.
On that, hashtag Mulelo likes this.
On that ridiculous note, Johnny Clegg's memoir, in his own words, has been published. It's about his childhood, his musical beginnings, the story of his founding of Jaluka in the most tumultuous time in South Africa's history. It's also the story of how the son of an unconventional mum and the grandson of Jewish immigrants came to realize and identify with the identity that he had that was a choice. And home is a place that you can leave and return to as sure as the seasons change. I had the most incredible conversation with this man not a few months before he died, and we still feel the gap left by him, but you can kind of fix that feeling with listening to his music, and that's going to be eternal. You know, there's a part of Johnny that will always be with us. And I'm just thrilled that we can this morning talk to both his sons, Jaron and Jesse, who are on the line to join us. Both of them, extraordinary people in their own right. Jaron is a filmmaker who's made award-winning music videos with his father, for his father while he was still around. And most recently, he's worked on the Halo TV series in Europe, which is based on the popular video game. He's also just directed a science fiction piece that's set in South Africa. So he's no slouch. Here he is, Jaron Clegg. Hey, Jaron, how are you, dude?
Hey, how are you guys? Nice. How's it, Gareth? How are you all doing?
Good to see you, man. And let's just welcome your bro as well, Jesse Clegg, a singer-songwriter well-known to us here at CliffCentral.com and to many people in South Africa too. Platinum-selling success, 8 top 10 singles. He's been nominated for 5 South African Music Awards. How are you doing, Jesse? We can't hear you, Jesse. I think you're on mute.
There we go. Good to be back. How's it, Gareth? Nice to see you, man.
Yeah, you got this hugely professional studio, but you forgot to unmute your microphone. That's terrific. Well done.
It's just, I don't know how to use it. I'm just in it.
No, it's brilliant. All right. So guys, first of all, let's just talk a little bit about your dad's incredible legacy. And, you know, that's fallen on your shoulders now, to continue. And there's so many people who feel, as I said in the introduction, they feel a gap that's been left by your dad, but his music is there to fill that gap. And now his stories, which I had a little bit of insight into when I spoke to him last, He really had some incredible stories. My God. I mean, Jesse, I think I spoke to you shortly after your dad died, and you told me how even as kids, he used to talk to you, you two, about all the incredible adventures that he'd been on when he was your age. And all of those stories, I hope, are included in this memoir because he was so good at storytelling.
Yeah, I mean, the one thing that is so beautiful about the memoir, which was quite surprising to me and my bro, is it is the adventure of a lifetime. I mean, it's his early years growing up in he was born in the United Kingdom, and then he grew up in then Rhodesia and Zambia and then South Africa, and going on this amazing journey through these African countries, and then eventually landing up in South Africa and meeting Charlie Mzila and experiencing Johannesburg in, you know, the late 70s. And just this amazing journey that he went on that was cultural, musical, an inward journey that helped him discover the man that he became. And it reads like an incredible adventure story, and it's such a beautiful version of South Africa, you know, through his eyes and his perspective, which is so unique. So he definitely shares it in the book, and he shares stuff that he's never shared before either. So it's really a special document, man.
So Jaron, like, tell us how you actually found the material for this, and how much of it your dad had written, and how much you had to piece together yourselves, and also whether there was stuff in that you'd never heard before, because you guys obviously knew him better than any of us did. But there must have been some things here, because, I mean, even, you know, if I look at my own family, if I think about the things my dad did as a kid, there's lots I don't know.
Absolutely. I mean, totally. You know, he pieced it together in the most dad-like way. It was like pure chaos. He did, you know, it was like voice notes. It was like documents. It was notes on his phone. It was messages to us. It was like these amazing anecdotes that he scattered out in all these different, basically as it came to him, it was kind of stream of consciousness, because I mean, his life, we'd like to say like he lived 1,000 lifetimes. He had such a rich range of experiences. So yeah. So he put it down wherever he could, basically. And then, you know, we sourced it with him, and we kind of got all the texts together. But there was a lot. And so when we finally went through it, it was an incredible eye-opener. There certainly were things that we weren't even privy to. You know, whether it's just like in detail how he describes trying to get to Zululand, you know, he always used to say, you know, it was a bit of a tough thing, you know, getting there with Sepal. But you know, we'd get there, and it was just the most fantastic time. But you know, he goes into detail about how like Sepal would have to hustle to get him a bus ticket, and like this bus driver would be very perplexed at this white kid on blacks only bus, and speaking in depth about, you know, how beautiful like the Tugela River Valley opening up, and like how it was a window into this other world. So yeah, he goes into incredible detail into these like sacred moments, and I think they were sacred to him. So in a way he kept a lot of that detail to himself until, you know, he really kind of spewed it out in this incredible book. So yeah, so that's how it came together, and we really pieced it together with Alison, who is the editor, and she did an incredible job of stringing these narratives together thematically, as opposed to a traditional consecutive narrative.
Let me just ask you two, because there's a part of this that's about you, even though the book is about your dad, and you've managed to piece together this incredible tapestry of stories and voice notes and clippings and, you know, bits and pieces he left lying around. Did it help you? Because, you know, we all have to lose our dads at some point. That's the way of the world. But a lot of people don't ever really have peace. They don't ever really get closure. They don't get to finally say goodbye in the right way. And I know that when you were going through this, it must have been extremely difficult. Did this book and putting together this book give you guys any catharsis? Did it help the family to kind of deal with his loss, because that stuff can sometimes be, you know, hugely insightful. It can teach you stuff about yourself and about your dad that you otherwise might not have had.
Yeah, it was a very difficult time, man. He passed towards the end of 2019, and then it was COVID the following year.
Yeah.
So we all had to hunker down, and it was amazing though, because we had this project. You know, we had all this stuff that my dad had written, and we knew that this was something that we wanted to honor. And we wanted to allow it to see the light of day. And so it was like a family project. And we sat with all his stories and his memories and his, he went and interviewed old bandmates and interviewed old friends from Zululand. And it was just this beautiful little cocoon that we could step into as a family and spend that time. You know, it felt like he was with us, even though we were grieving, there was this wonderful experience of just reliving his life and honoring it by documenting it and making sure that there was this, this piece that he had put together that he wanted to share. So it was a gift that he left us, man. And it really brought us a lot of closure. And for us, I think to have a living document of that time of his life, where it literally it feels like he's in the room talking to you. He wrote it so conversational, it's so true to his voice.
Yeah.
Man, it really did bring us a huge amount of comfort.
There must be so many people from all over the world who helped in small ways or big ways to contribute to this. I mean, here's Michael who listens to the show, and he says, in the early 90s, I went to interview Johnny at his house on a Sunday, which was his only available day off. He cooked me breakfast as we chatted. I so loved that guy. That's the kind of thing your dad did, right? And there's so many people who felt they had a connection with him because he was just such a straight up dude. He was just so fun to be around, so relaxed, so confident, like without being arrogant, he managed to just like fill the room with a quiet confidence. And I think that came from all these experiences he had as a young man. And he helped South Africa to find our confidence in some ways, don't you think?
Absolutely. He was an incredible, I think something that he really did with his career is, I mean, he completely compartmentalized, kind of over compartmentalized his career in a way. He didn't take it all to celebrity. It wasn't at all his thing. It didn't align with any of his values. He really was, and I think his whole life story speaks to this. He was a junkie on like really connecting, being present, like really connecting with people in front of him. And so I think, it's incredible how he was able to overcome that, and I mean, well, to navigate that kind of crazy space, and to just still stay this incredibly humble, present person.
So, I mean, both of you could probably have a go at answering this. I remember the last time I spoke to your dad, he was talking to me about anthropology, and he was talking to me about the big picture stuff, like kind of the story of humanity, the story of South Africa, how our differences are so small and the things that we have in common are so big. And that was such a part of what he was doing in his musical career too. But there was this scientist and this really curious, really educated, really sophisticated human being too. He used to lecture people. He could talk. I mean, if you gave your dad a runway and he had time and he had the inclination, he could talk about the most incredible things. Undoubtedly, a lot of musicians, people look at one dimensionally and they go, well, they're a great songwriter, a great singer, great performer. Your dad was all of those things, but also in other ways that are completely unrelated to music, this man was a marvel.
I think that the beauty of the book is that you really get to see the inception of that man. He documents quite beautifully the time he spent at Wits University and his time as a lecturer, and he was not a great student in high school, and he had quite a chaotic and unconventional childhood. He didn't have a father figure. A lot of the adults in his life, let him down.
Yeah.
And when he discovered Zulu culture and Zulu philosophy and the music and a means to express himself, I think it unleashed something in him that was very profound and very deep. And when he got to university and he immersed himself in a world of ideas, he just had this incredible awakening. And, you know, I think he was someone who, I mean, he always impressed that upon us. You know, he loved academia and he loved, he had such a deep curiosity about the world, such an incredible openness and inquisitiveness. And he always said to us, you'll never regret gaining knowledge. You know, you must go and study and, you know, immerse yourself in a world of academia because there is so much value to gain. There's so much, expands your horizons. And I'm certainly very grateful that he impressed that upon us because it's expanded our horizons as well.
Wow.
Yeah. So I think, He was like a Renaissance man. You know, he could dance, he could sing, he could wax philosophical. You know,
could he cook though? I mean, was that breakfast that he made?
I actually don't think he could cook. I think that was his one downfall.
the one thing.
He was very impatient. I remember whenever he would bribe, he would always burn the food.
Wow. We finally found Johnny Clegg's downfall.
it took this long for us to get there, so that's nothing to be ashamed of. I mean, I wonder how many of us can cook. I'll put my hand up as being useless in that department too. So guys,
likewise,
it's not just me. So let me go meta for a second here, if you don't mind, because you just brought up the fact that, you know, a lot of the, it wasn't his mom seems to have been an incredible human being, but a lot of the men in his life kind of let him down when he was a child. And then Zulu culture, not only, I remember him saying this, it taught him also how to be a man, which is something which I know in South Africa a lot of people are struggling with at the moment because male role models are hard to come by in South Africa. And there are many young people, especially young guys, who are not raised by their fathers. And we have a gap in our society which has never really been filled. There is, however, on the meta, there is this incredible man who you guys were privileged to call your father. And you've both inherited an enormous amount of talent from this guy and creativity. So when you look back on it, if you had to, you know, kind of give it context and perspective, and this is really hard to do, but I'm going to ask you anyway, when you look at that stuff, how much do you think, looking at your own dad, is nature and how much is nurture and how much of that is in you?
Do you mean in terms of how much of nature and nurture was kind of brought him up?
Yeah, and then in turn, what you guys received from him from a nature point of view, and then from a nurture point of view, you know, how much is in the genes?
That's a great question. I think Jesse hinted at it quite well. You know, he had this in quite a insane void in his life. In his early years, because of the kind of the chaos, this congruence of chaos that led to him, you know, having a lacking of paternal values in his life, because, you know, the only father figure he had really disappeared. And it led him to really journeying into, you know, trying to find an anchor, a paternal anchor in his life. And that was kind of that's kind of a situation he had and what he was born into. And but his nature as a person is, I think, what allowed him to make these beautiful magical connections, because as Jesse said, he was just so open and really deeply curious. And I think that is what allowed him to connect so profoundly with Sipho. You know, they were soulmates and the best of friends you could ever hope to have. And it allowed, you know, the key players on the other side of the aisle to really embrace him, like totally, unconditionally, and to induct him into Sipho's clan. So his is definitely a great example of how just being open to the world and really having this innocence can help shape your journey and how others can see it and how they can, you know, have an impact on your life if you're really open to it. And certainly he definitely shared that with us, and he always told us to, as Jesse said, you know, just go expand your horizons, be open, try academia, but also just, you know, live on a wide spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I think Jesse and I both certainly have taken that on, and we always try and channel that, you know, going into any, whether it's some crazy wild challenge, you know, that, you know, whether it's like on set, if it's like raining like crazy, I'd kind of just think of my dad. You know, my dad would be smiling, saying, you know, this is another, you have to worry through this, you know, this is just another one of those experiences to kind of expand, and to flesh you out as a person. So certainly, yeah, I mean, for me, but Jess, what would you say?
Yeah, geez, man. My dad, you know, we're all products of our environment, I think. But my dad is such an interesting case of, I think, nature, because he actually had a very difficult upbringing, a very difficult childhood. And when you look at the pressures that were exerted on him as a young man, I think that his life could have taken many different directions. But his core humanity, his love for human connection and curiosity, it guided him in the most incredible way. There's this hidden force in my dad's life that just guided him along the right path. It's incredible to, when you read it, it's just incredible to watch it unfold. And, you know, in our case, he was a wonderful father. He was someone who gave us the tools to face our life and to face challenges. And so, you know, it's the age old debate, nature versus nurture. But I mean, you know, in every case, it's a weird combination of things, I guess.
It's really interesting to hear you say all of this now with a bit of reflection. You called it Scatterling of Africa. Of course, one of his most famous songs. I'm not even sure how you would rank those songs, because there's so many of them that I listen to. You know, even over this last weekend, I've been listening to your dad's music, and not in preparation for this interview, just because it's on my playlists. And when you think of, like,
nice.
Of course. And if you think about how to write a memoir, and to then, well, in this case, you're putting it together from stuff that has already been written and recorded, which is a little bit harder. And then to name it, was there a bit of a to and fro about what to call it? Because you could have called it any number of things. All of his great music being part of it.
Yeah, well, Scatterling was his favorite song of his own body of work.
Really?
He always said that it was the song that launched his career, and it's a song about how we all have, in a deep sense, our origins in Africa.
Yes.
And we're all scatterlings of Africa. And yes. My dad was truly that. You know, he was someone who wasn't even born in Africa, but he found himself there and he came home. And you know, he was saved by Africa in such a deep sense. You know, the Zulu culture and the Zulu community and the friendships that he made, lifelong friendships, in a real way saved his life, you know. And I think that we all felt like it was a name that was fitting of who he was and the story that this book tells, which is about Africa and about someone finding themselves in Africa.
Sure. I didn't know that it was his favorite song, but now that you say it, it makes perfect sense. And it even brings in that anthropological stuff that we were talking about just a second ago. It's a perfect name for it. So, okay. Is this a book we can buy? Is it something we can also get online for Kindle? Is it available all over the place? Like, this is where we do the marketing push. So tell me where because I mean, I'm sure that everybody listening to this now is going, okay, well, you've sold it now. Where can we get it? Right.
So it's the physical book is available in all good bookstores, and the audio book and the digital versions are not yet released, but they will be out very soon. So, but for now, it's the physical, and it's out nationwide.
There we go. I just want to go to some of the comments here. Michael, who got your dad to cook him breakfast once, says, if you're a South African living overseas, hearing Johnny Clegg on the radio always stops you in your tracks and turns your heart towards home. That's about right.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
Lovely Lady Lee says, Johnny Clegg's The Crossing, Osieza. That song always gives me goosebumps. Beautiful. You two are both such good-looking guys, according to Moonchild. So there's something else there. Here. But let's give your mother some
credit. Put it in your pants, Moonchild.
Let's give your mom some credit there. I mean, come on, you know, it's not like she didn't play a role here. We haven't mentioned your mom once here, and then that's a whole other story. I mean, she's been an incredible pillar of strength.
She's writing her own book.
Good. That book would be interesting.
All those Cleggs.
Yeah. She should call it Trying to Survive with All These Clegg Men Around.
Yeah.
Rudy says, I haven't seen my dad in 17 years. What these boys received from their dad was absolute gold, and that is something to treasure. Yeah. You just said it now, Jesse. You know, he gave you the tools to be able to stand up and be men yourselves. And there's nothing better a father could hear than those words, I'm sure.
That's what's amazing for me is that he was – I mean, I might be speaking out of turn, but taking it from the stories that you're telling, he was given very little to nothing from a father figure in his life. Mm. And to be able to turn that into this magic that he's passed on is just amazing. I mean, if you look at the way humans are, sometimes history repeats itself. And in this case, it was the total opposite.
Totally, yeah. He broke the cycle. I mean, he was... incredible. He had an incredible duality as a father. He had these Zulu warrior values that were at his core and genuinely were. I mean, that was who he was. And so he had these paternal values that he gave to us, but he also in duality to that had this, he was incredibly vulnerable with us and open. And he would always, you know, he'd share his fears with us and he'd tell us, you know, when he, you know, that he loved us or when he was having a happy moment. You know, he wasn't just this like wall of, you know, paternal values that just, you know, to be strong always. He had this beautiful duality. And
was there anything that you found out that you were really shocked about or you thought, I kind of wish I never knew that?
I don't know. Yes. I mean, I think that the for me, it was just shocking to see how chaotic some of the family members were. Some of the, you know, his grandfather and his stepfather were both very eccentric people. His real father he never met until he was in his 20s. But you know, there's a lot of big characters in the book. His mom as well was a very eccentric person and gave him. She was a complicated parent figure. You know, she supported him and loved him, but she also had her own shortcomings and challenges in her life. And, you know, my dad, in a way, had to parent himself. So I think that was, you know, you always hear about your extended family, but when you actually read it in a book that documents all the chaotic things that happened, it's quite surprising.
Yeah.
Bulelo's back, and Snai Zulu's just going to say here quickly, Jan Bulelo, what do you have to say about the Zulus now? What do you have to say about the Zulus now? Especially because we've got two more Zulus on the show this morning. But you guys were raised in all of that too, right? I mean, Jesse, you spent the first 6 years of your life on tour, and I'm sure Jaron, you were like inducted into all of this just as much as Jesse.
Yeah, I was also on tour.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. What's the age gap? Age gap between you two, by the way?
It's 7 years.
That's a hell of a gap. Sure.
Yeah. Yeah. No, we definitely were. We were totally, I mean, it was such a, it's an odd thing. You think like when you grow up, you think all these things are very normal, you know, that you're, we're going to be in Joburg for like 6 months and then we're going to be in Zululand for another 3 months. You know, we're going to be back and forth or we're going to be touring. We're going to be in Europe. You know, you kind of think all these things are just part of every kid's childhood. But yeah, it was definitely, we were incredibly lucky to have experienced and to have gone into, you know, to be in Zululand so much and to make like lifelong friendships there, you know, playing with Sipho's kids and getting to know his whole family. Yeah, we were incredibly lucky.
Are you guys all still close? Do you still communicate with them?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. We just saw him a few weeks ago. He came up, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, and Charlie Mzila, the first guy to teach my dad's guitar, he lives with me. Buffer Zun still lives with us. Like, you know, these people are family to us. You know, they really are. And I mean, Sipo and his family are literally like extended family to us.
Well, look, guys, I mean, we've been talking about your dad this morning, which you've been doing your whole lives. But there's so much we could talk to you about individually. And you've both got these incredible and stellar careers. And you make us very proud. I mean, I'm sure your dad was extremely proud and told you that the whole time. But you're also, you know, you're kids of the whole South African mishpocha. So whether you like it or not, we're also hugely impressed by all the things that you've done on your own individual levels. And thank you for making time for us this morning. It's so great to have you both on and to talk to you about this this incredible memoir. So there we go, Jesse and Jaron Clegg. It's so great to have you on. The book is called Scatterling of Africa, Johnny Clegg's memoir in his own words. And it should be available at all good bookstores or online. And hopefully we'll have some pictures in there as well. The music will be playing in our heads while we're reading it. It's just perfect. Perfect.
Thank you so much for having us, man.
Thanks so much.
Pleasure.
Thanks, guys. Thank you. There we go. Jesse and Jaron Clegg. Isn't that cool? Good to have them both on, huh?
Mm.
What awesome guys. Mm. Yeah, I mean, that's a hell of a legacy to be responsible for now.
Wow. Yeah.
Quite incredible. All right, well, we've got George Meany coming back to join us in just a moment or two. The Auto Trader Pod, which is coming on in just a second or two. And we've also got the MKT show today, and it is Friday. Any exciting things happening this weekend?
It's an international break in the football, but it's Formula One this weekend for those people who like an afternoon nap.
Formula One,
Yeah, it's lekker. You drop that thing lekker.
That's great.
Yes, you don't go too fast. The defibrillator is about to blow out or whatever.
Defibrillator. I'm sure that's a machine for, you know, like the heart, but okay.
I don't know.
Yes, it is.
It is one of those... I don't know, cars, but that's what these all sound like to me from the south.
Cars,
all the guys Leanne was dating.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Sweeping up the courses, yeah. And then there's rugby, obviously, the Springboks. The one last thing that's left in South Africa we can rely on is the Springboks. So they're playing Scotland this weekend.
In sport terms, let's just be clear, in sport terms, well, lots of other stuff we can be quite proud of. Mm-hmm.
I meant in sport, yeah.
Yeah. No, that's all I'm saying. Just don't throw you the MKT show today at 1 if there's load shedding, at 12 if there isn't load shedding. Lest we forget, we were once the world global electricity supplier winner back in 2008, says Tracy. Yeah, that's true, but we were not.
What does that even mean?
I don't know.
Like, how do you get an award? That's like perfect attendance, you know, at school as a certificate. Like, it's nonsense.
I want to go to George because George is always talking about electric cars, but with all this load shedding, I wonder if George has been stuck at home because he's a big electric car fan. Hey, George Meany, how are you?
Hey, Gareth. Hi, George. Hello, Brianne. Hello, Morletto. No, I actually haven't been stuck at home. You know, I'm I suppose fortunate to have off-grid solar systems.
You really are a man of the future. This is where we need to be reminded of this on a weekly basis, because a lot of people who think about electric cars go, oh, you're not better with this car, blah, blah, blah. But the kind of people who are thinking about electric cars are thinking about providing themselves with off-the-grid electricity too. So are you completely off the grid? I remember you told us once, but I've forgotten.
Yeah, so, I mean, you can make a couple of mistakes. I made a few mistakes in setting up the system. Initially, I had the wrong inverters installed.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I don't want to get into a lengthy discussion about inverters and off-grid solar systems, but you can end up installing the wrong inverters if you're going to go for cheap and cheerful. Inverters have to have three outlets. Gets a bit technical, but has to have three outlets. One of the outlets need to be able to supply your what's called your non-essential load. So usually when they put inverters and off-grid systems in your house, You've got the essential load, which is the plugs and the lights, and then the non-essential loads, which is your stove, your heavy use stuff. And most solar systems only supply non-essential loads. So when the electricity goes off during load shedding, you've got lights and plugs. You can use the microwave, but you can't use the stove or the geysers.
Or your hairdryer.
Well, you can use a hairdryer, but it's going to put strain on the system, depending on the size of the inverter. I've got two inverters at 8 kilowatts each.
Let me tell you, Leanne has a very powerful hairdryer, so it completely saps the power from any inverter. Apparently, her hairdryer is huge. It used to be used by the women in Dallas in the 80s, and she inherited it. It's that big.
It's got the power of three leaf blowers backwards.
Oh my god. Oh, by the way, on that note, my leaf blower neighbor has a generator, so even in load shedding, lucky me, I get to hear next door the whole time. And I've told you, their gardener is in love with the leaf blower. The guy's got an affair going on with that thing. All right, so Borge, what have we got going on this morning? Tell us what's happening.
You know, it was Halloween last month, no doubt, an American study, America always conducts these interesting studies. An American study came out that nothing better to do, that proved that pedestrian death rates are up. Up to 22%.
Wow!
During Halloween. So, but the study went even further, and it proved that the day of the week that Halloween falls will determine how high the death rate is for pedestrians. This is for pedestrians, not for cars.
Oh.
Cars knocking over pedestrians, because you know you're walking around trick or treating. And it turns out that Friday is the worst day to have Halloween.
More people get killed on a Friday Halloween than any other.
Than any other day. Best day to have Halloween, actually a Saturday.
Yeah, well, because there's less traffic. But George, I hope this isn't like kids who are being killed because they're trick-or-treating. That would be even more horrible. Bad enough if it's adults. Even worse if it's kids.
Partly is kids, Gareth. So that is very sad. Maybe the world should move to having Halloween on a Saturday always.
When I heard death rates on Halloween, I immediately thought heart attacks from people getting fights.
Yeah, that is also a thing. By the way, that's also a thing. We know that, you know, a lot of kids are nervous about this stuff, and they get nervous when someone goes boo, and then adults even get scared. Listen, some of these outfits are pretty damn terrifying, and I know Halloween was a couple of weeks ago now, but it can be really, really scary when you see, like, you know, these famous movies like the actual Halloween movie or Nightmare on Elm Street or whatever, and some of these makeup jobs that people do are so good. I went to a Halloween party and there were one or two people who'd gone all out, like the outfit, the makeup, their hair. It's, and we're not talking sexy, like, you know, slutty nurse or any of that stuff, like really scary monsters. And if I were a little child and one of those things answered the door, I'd shit myself, no doubt.
Jeez. Yeah, I'm looking for a photograph. I'll send it to you afterwards, Gareth. But okay. 1 year, I dressed up as a vampire, and I got these contact lenses.
Oh,
I can't find them.
Scary.
I got these blue. I mean, my eyes are already blue, and these contact lenses. It looked like you could see through. Well, the other person's other people said it looked like you could see through them.
Oh wow!
Wow.
Yeah, that's amazing. All right, so what else is in the news from a motoring point of view?
Well, in Australia. Now, Australia is to the British Commonwealth what Florida is to the United States in Leanne's terms. So in Australia, this 70-year-old man was snapped on a speeding camera on the bonnet of a car with his beer in his hand, doing 120 kilometers per hour.
These speed cameras have caught...
So wait, somebody else must have been driving while he was sitting on the bonnet.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And the other person had a beer out the window.
at 120 Ks per hour.
Yes, that's
this dangerous. Old man was Jeepers. On the bonnet.
This old so, man, he was drunk.
He was going.
He was
at
sitting on the trunk.
There we go. Nice. All right. Very good. But George, it seems to me, there's a lot of these speed cameras that pick up things they're not meant to pick up. Now that we live in a society where Big Brother's watching you everywhere, we're picking up on just how dumb and crazy people are.
Well, we have cameras in our estate, and obviously it's a public protection of information challenge in some instances. But there's some of the stupid stuff that people do at 2 o'clock in the morning and gets picked up by these cameras is unbelievable.
How do you even hold on to a bonnet at that speed? I don't understand.
Some serious skill, actually.
Yeah.
Wow.
With a beer in there. I think it's very dangerous. I mean, people get up to strange things, I suppose. But
maybe I should show everybody the picture, because that would be a good idea, right? Let me just see if I can pull this picture up here, because that's hilarious. And it's not an old man. How old is he?
No, I thought he was 74. They were doing 74 miles per hour, which was 120 kilometers per hour. So
that's incredible.
Let me just put the picture up, so everyone can see this. It's awesome. I mean, what an incredibly stupid human being. We know people do dumb stuff, but really, now that we have cameras everywhere, it's so obvious to see that people, we should just not be trusted. This guy's, he's lying down. He's not even holding onto the bonnet, Leanne. I don't know how he managed to do this. Take a look at this picture. It's absolutely insane. Here's the guy. He's lying down. He's got his feet on the front fender, which sticks up a little bit from the bar.
He's got his feet pushing against the bull bar. That's how he's holding on.
Still at 120 Ks an hour.
And let's just bear in mind, this is in Western Australia, huh? This is not an American. Usually these crazy stories come from America. This is Western Australia, which obviously is also it's the other side of Australia, not the rules and law and order side of Australia, the more the crazy lunatic side.
I stand to be corrected, but I believe Perth is maybe the most isolated sort of major city in the Western world. I may be wrong, but because of how far they are from, they're way out west. So it's probably somewhere there. These didgeridoo, kookaburra, Wurrunga people. Oh.
That's where most of the South Africans live. So perhaps he was South African.
In reading that story, like the weird slang that Australia comes up with, I didn't know they call a beer a frothy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
A frothy, mate.
A frothy.
And you know, like drinking and driving there, well, it's just from my experience when I was there, is like a traveler, is just, they call it a traveler. It's just a normal thing. Like having a beer in the car, a traveler, is, like here we like, whoa, they drinking call it a traveler there. Yeah. I was like, Jesus, you bloody, yes.
You know, South Africa.
One for the road.
South Africans go one for the road. Australians are like, nah, I'm taking a whole six pack, mate.
It's a pack
of travelers.
Oh, it's amazing. Someone says here that it's a Ford driver. That makes sense. So clearly, Beth's Eleutheria not very nice.
A lot of South Africans there because it is a bucky.
I hope it's not a South African. That would be even more embarrassing. Let's just hope it's an Australian. When Steering Pikachu makes a good point, keep in mind on a motorbike, you can hit 300 Ks an hour and you're pretty much just holding on. That's a good point.
That's true.
So let's not
Yeah, but you're clutching onto the motorbike with your knees.
All right, what else is going on?
The new cars by 2026 could have laws passed. This obviously comes out of the US as well. Mm-hmm. Could have laws passed to detect drunk drivers. So the authorities might put laws in place that say if you want to have your car legal on the road as an OEM,
your car has to be able to detect a drunk driver, which is interesting that regulation is going in this direction. I mean, cars can already detect sleepiness, which, you know, you've spoken about a lot before, Gareth, that, you know, in your opinion, and I agree with you, that fatigue is probably worse than drunk driving, but it doesn't it doesn't mean that drunk driving is not bad. It's just fatigue is bad. So cars can already detect fatigue. But it might become a legal thing that cars have to be manufactured with something that can detect a drunk person.
Yeah, those are called eyes in Western Australia. You could just see the person is drunk because they've got a frothy in their hand. Great. But you're talking about those. You're talking about those devices that, you know, they kind of, they're in the car and the car won't start unless you breathe into it and you don't have alcohol in your breath.
Yeah, the big conundrum by the lawmakers at the moment apparently is, do they regulate the car? You know, so if you've, let's say you start your journey off and you're not drunk and then you become drunk, do they regulate the fact that your car has to be able to kind of disable itself or something?
That could lead to some trouble.
So I think there's more complexity.
You know how drunk people are? They swear at things that aren't even alive, like a car, for example. Come on, you piece of shit, start. Imagine people getting angry. It's hilarious. Listen, I still don't know how or why it's necessary for people to drive drunk. I used to do it. I can't believe I did it. I felt like such an idiot. Maybe I'm just talking like this because I'm an old man now. But the fact is, you can always get an Uber these days. You don't need to take the risk.
Yeah, that's so true. There's a lot of options. You know, you don't need to. I don't drink and drive. Even with, you know, the minimum one beer. I mean, don't really drink beer, but I won't drink and drive. Full stop.
Well,
it's just my own personal.
Here's a suggestion: if anybody is trying to circumvent the law in this case, keep a kid in the boot just to blow and start the car.
That's awesome. That's a problem solver right there.
Put one of your children.
I used to like driving around with my grandpa because I could park in the disabled parkings when he was with me.
So great. Oh, that's great. All right. Anything else, George?
Two more things. One is UK is gearing up to make rare earth permanent magnets. Now, let me give you the backstory. Rare earth permanent magnets, and you probably know a lot of this, Gareth, because you're into elements and chemicals and stuff. Rare earth magnets are very strong permanent magnets and made of alloys. So you don't dig the magnets out of the ground. They're made out of alloys that come from rare earth elements. They've developed in the 1970s and 80s. These rare earth magnets produce a significantly stronger magnetism than other kinds of magnets. Okay. Now, the link to the topic of the day is electric vehicles use permanent magnets in their electric motors. It's what makes the car more efficient. Mm-hmm. And rare earth magnets then mean that the car uses less of its battery because the magnetism helps the armatures spin. So the UK walked away from manufacturing rare earth magnets in the 1990s because they just couldn't compete with China. Yep. Now, with the demand of EVs in Europe and the UK, the UK is now thinking of regenerating the production of rare earth magnets because of these EVs. So it shows you how electric vehicles or a change in transformation of a particular industry changes the economics in that country significantly.
Sure. I mean, these rare earth metals are also hard to come by, hence the term rare earth. But one of the elements they use is something called neodymium, which is part of that alloy that you're talking about. And they do produce very strong magnets. In fact, they say if you swallow one of those magnets, it could kill you because if the other one is on the outside, it'll pull it through your organs. That's how strong some are.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. You don't want to mess around with like these really super powerful magnets. Obviously, the ones we're talking about now are not like that. But some of these things are so strong and they use them in cyclotrons and all kinds of complicated equipment. But if we can use them in cars and they do a better job, why not?
Exactly. And then very finally, got a bit of an EV quiz for anybody out there who wants to. Everybody has to make this little mind shift, and it's little, and it's not as complicated as one might think. So How do you measure fuel consumption in a fossil fueled car?
Wait, we're doing this as a proper quiz now. Are you ready? Okay, here it is.
What's a fossil fuel car?
It's the George Meany quiz. Da, 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 da. And here's your host, George Meany. Everybody, let's make some noise. Let's. There we go. Very good.
Fastest fingers first. How do you measure fuel consumption in a fossil fuel car?
What's a fossil fuel car?
Like the one you drive.
What you drive.
Oh. No, that's just a fossil driving a fuel car.
You measure it in I want to try. You measure it in how many kilometers or miles you get out of a liter.
Per liter, yeah.
Yes, that's one of the ways to measure the fuel consumption in a fossil fuel car, kilometers per liter of fuel used. Some people measure liters per 100 kilometers. So if you've got a 50 liter tank and you're doing 10 kilometers per liter of fuel, your car can do 500 kilometers on a tank of fuel.
Sure.
Simple, right?
Right.
Mm. So, how do you measure fuel consumption in an electric vehicle?
Battery life.
Watts per squats.
Battery life per over time?
Well, it's almost the exact same calculation, Gareth. So you measure watt hours, kilometers per watt hour, or kilowatt hours per 100 kilometers. So it's almost exactly the same calculation. And people think it's very confusing, but you know, if you really just sit and think about it for about 3 or 4 minutes, it's the same calculation. If you can do 25 kilowatt hours per 100 kilometers and you have a 90 kilowatt hour battery, you can do roughly 360 kilometers. Sure. If you do it the other way around, 4 kilometers per kilowatt hour, and you've got a 90 kilowatt hour battery, then you can do 360 kilometers on the full charge of your battery.
Right. Hmm. Okay, that's impressive. Any other questions?
No, that's it. That's all I have this week.
All right, so thank you very much for joining us on the George Meany quiz this morning. We love having you with us, and our host, George Meany, is going to prepare another question for you for next week. Yes, I know you're very excited about that. Thank you very much to our studio audience for participating in the quiz, and to 3Ann Moll, to Mbulelo Tinta, to George Meany, and from me, the co-host of the show, Gareth Cliff. We will see you next week for more. Have a great weekend, everybody. Cheers. Be good. CliffCentral.com